another shutdown averted. Holcomb's teacher pay commission is missing something. That plus school safety money for firearm training and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending February 15th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, federal lawmakers struck a deal which President Trump signed to fund the government and avoid another shutdown. The deal, totaling hundreds of billions of dollars, funds the federal government through the remainder of the current fiscal year, which runs through September. It does include money for a physical barrier at the nation's southern border with Mexico, but only $1.37 billion, far less than the nearly $6 billion President Trump demanded to build a wall. Trump expressed dislike with the deal, but word from the White House was he would sign it to avoid another shutdown while moving forward with executive actions to follow through on his campaign promise to build the wall. Indiana Senator Todd Young voted for the funding deal, while his Hoosier colleague Mike Braun did not. Is the federal funding deal a loss for the president? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, President Trump got some money for the wall, and now he's clearly going to go after more. Is that good enough for his base?
Oh, his base is with him no matter what he does. I mean, he could, as he says, kill somebody in Times Square and they'd still be with him. But it's a loss for him. It's less money than he could have had in December before he shut down the government for 35 days. Now, he was worried about his numbers plummeting with people who are not in his camp, and obviously the people in his camp are not enough to reelect him next time around. But I think even more worrisome than whether this is a political loss for him or not is that the attempt on his part to use executive powers to do what Congress didn't do for him is a usurpation of the congressional function. It's unconstitutional on top of that, and it is reprehensible because it does destroy the balance of power between the two branches. And it's not even forward thinking because, you know, if you could just declare an emergency, which is what he's doing, because he didn't get all the money that he wanted out of Congress, you know, the next president, which God willing will be a Democrat, will come in there and say, you know what, we have a national emergency, climate change, gun violence. Let's do something about that. And let's take money from wherever we can take it. You know, he produced a budget saying he needed that much money for defense. Okay? Was he lying when he produced that budget, or is he lying now when he's taking the money away?
That idea of future presidents using the same kind of authority to do something really big, is that in Republicans' minds as they debate whether or not to support the president on this?
I mean, I think it's in everyone's minds. Certainly Nancy Pelosi was talking a lot about this. But, you know, taking a couple of steps back, clearly Ann doesn't listen to conservative talk radio because there were some pundits who were critical.
You mean those talking heads
who were critical of the president agreeing to a compromise deal, but it was the right decision. You know, so we've avoided a shutdown. We have gotten funding for operations, and we've avoided the one that would have happened.
There's a second shutdown
on the 15th is what I'm talking about. And so we have gotten funding for border security. Look, the issue of border security is real, no matter how much Democrats act like it isn't. And Democrats used to support funding a wall. They used to support border security.
In certain places, the wall
makes
sense.
They used to support compromises. Now they just want open borders. And there are serious problems. There are drugs, violence, human trafficking issues at the border. And the more that you talk and listen to and read stories from people who are along the border, the more compelling the case is, and you understand that we have to do something.
If you listen to the border security people,
has now taken action.
They'll tell you that the problem with drugs comes at the natural borders where there are not fences.
John,
Did you see the angel moms who confronted Jim Acosta at the press conference?
We've seen Republicans or clips unearthed, including of Mike Pence, criticizing this kind of broad executive action. Is that just in the rearview mirror, doesn't matter anymore?
As a practical matter, yes, but that point is well taken. I was just going to say this is a great showcasing of an American tradition in Congress or in every governmental office of, shall we say, ideological inconsistency or maybe hypocrisy. Because if you look at the last year or two of the Obama administration, where Barack Obama was fairly open with his frustration about gridlock in Congress and his inability to get much done, he was pushing the envelope. He admitted pushing the envelope in terms of executive action and so forth. And of course, if you go back and you review clips from that period or look at newspaper headlines about Republican members of Congress being quoted, they were outraged at this usurpation of, power. And they were
Republican members of Congress have been critical so far.
But
too.
It just shows that, you know, things have a way. It's all relative. It tends to be relative. Who's in the White House? Who's in power?
How does this play with the American people?
Well, it obviously depends which side you're on. I mean, if you want it or not. I just think I'm not actually sure why he needs the extra money. He's, from what I've been told, an excellent businessman. And we've gone from a big, beautiful, solid concrete wall to essentially a fence. I mean, do we still need $5 billion for a fence?
And by the way, the money, the $1.3 or $1.4 billion that was appropriated for the fence last year with Democratic support, they haven't even started construction. Okay,
well,
so the national emergency is really not real. And this is what dictators do.
Let me just plug, since this is public broadcast, NPR this week I thought has been doing something interesting. They've been talking not to members of ICE officials, but to police chiefs and mayors in border communities. You know, how are you boarded up, you know, inside because of the crazy crisis? Well, no one really has found the crisis.
Yeah.
So if you talk to people, apparently, as NPR, I have not made these contacts directly, but relying on that outlet, if ICE sees it, the people who are living it and enforcing the laws right on the border on the American side have yet to notice it.
Yeah.
Well, Governor Holcomb announced the members of his teacher pay commission this week, and there's not a current K-12 educator on that 7-member panel. Holcomb announced the creation of the 2-year commission during his State of the State. The 7-member group will study long-term sustainable ways to increase teacher salaries, a top priority for both parties at the State House this year. But the 7 people appointed to the commission are principally business leaders. The only member directly tied to education is Ivy Tech Vice President Katie Jenner. There will be an advisory council that assists the commission. That group is made up in part of K-12 educators and administrators. Jennifer Hollowell, why isn't there a teacher on the primary commission?
Well, it's really simple, because this committee, this commission, isn't being charged with questions about whether or not teachers need increased pay. That decision's already been made. They don't need to be on the panel to make the case for that. What they're being charged with is taking a holistic approach, looking at the state's budget, finances, funding, processes, pension liability, all these sorts of things to figure out how we increase teachers' pay and what the right decisions are. This is a lot of money that we're talking about. And so the governor has convened a group of business leaders who have managed enterprises with budgets of hundreds of millions of dollars and different business silos and mergers and turnarounds and all sorts of things. And it's a business and financing question that they're being charged with, and so they're the right people to lead it. Now, that said, there are educators on the advisory council, and the ISTA provided recommendations for the panel, and at least one of the people that they recommended is on the panel.
Right.
It's not the right people for the right task.
It's not like K-12 educators or administrators are being shut out of this entirely.
That's nonsense, okay? You have a state budget agency, okay? You have an appropriations committee in both houses, and you know what? They're charged with doing the exact same thing. This is a typical Republican kick-the-can-down-the-road response, and it is a slap in the face to educators, as Representative Paff said. It is, because it isn't just about finding the money. We know how to find the money. We've talked about this before. You stop the phase out of the corporate taxes. Okay? That's how you find the money.
You should just have a sign that you
I should, because that's exactly, you know, in this state, we freeze property taxes and we cut taxes and we cut taxes and we cut taxes. And then we say, why don't we have money to pay teachers? Why are our roads like, you know, like a third world country? Well, that's why. You get what you pay for. And that's the thing that Republicans can't deal with. So they want to kick the can further down the road. It isn't just a question of how you find the money. It is what's appropriate as a starting salary for teachers. And what is not appropriate is that somebody can walk out of high school with no set skills set and make the same money that teachers start as starting salaries in many of our counties. That's reprehensible.
Jen just made the compelling argument for why the commission was set up as it is. But is this the old perception problem?
Absolutely. I mean, I get it. The administration wanted sort of a group that wasn't vested in the outcome, didn't have sort of an agenda or a preconceived notion of what a competitive salary might be or anything like that. But, you know, what, you couldn't have made it 9 members and had thrown on a couple just so it doesn't look like another slap in the face? I mean, teachers are already really angry, and this just seemed like it should have been a layup and turned into, you know, a missed
Hail Mary
dunk.
And public education is there are nuances. It's an entity that requires some particular knowledge. I mean, people spend their entire careers trying to understand school operations, school funding. Just because someone is a captain of industry, a titan in the corporate world, and able to break down the silos you mentioned and, you know, make millions or billions, doesn't necessarily mean that you have a sensitivity to K through 12 education. And I do think there's some nuance and some difference there. And it does come down to perception, and it's a bit surprising because one thing it seemed to me that the administration, the Holcomb administration, had been doing well was in managing this issue was really not only informing the Indiana State Teachers Association, but seeming to want to enlist them as a partner. And maybe they still do want to, and that's why there's this advisory council.
Yeah.
But in some ways, it seems to me the best way to secure ownership of the solution is to, say, invite the leadership of the teachers' union to be part of coming up with the answer. Then you're almost guaranteed that there will be. It might have been some internal infighting or some difficulties coming up with a solution. But I think
or when a dissenting opinion.
But when there is a solution, it would be hard for teachers, at least organized unions representing teachers, to criticize it or pick it apart.
Well, bills in both the House and Senate would direct state school safety dollars to firearms training for teachers. School safety improvement has been a top issue for Indiana lawmakers since last year in the wake of school shootings both around the country and here in the Hoosier State. A Senate bill would allow schools to use the existing school safety grants for firearm training for teachers. The House version of the idea does the same, except it also specifies the type of training the money must be used for. A 40-hour specialized program that includes training in safe handling, storage, cleaning, marksmanship, and the legal ramifications of the use of force. Indiana teachers are already allowed to carry firearms in school without any training if local school boards sanction it.
John Schwanes, improving school safety is a popular issue. It's on the top of everybody's list. Does this complicate that?
I think by definition it complicates it. And I wouldn't say just the ease with which these measures move through the House of Origin or the General Assembly itself are not an indication of the complexities of the issue. Because if you look at, say, teachers, the ones who are actually in the classroom, every poll I've seen, and now granted these are mostly national polls of teachers across the country. I haven't seen anything, let me offer that caveat, of Indiana that's Indiana specific. But teachers overwhelmingly do not want to be armed or do not want their colleagues armed. The job is stressful enough as it is. Sometimes the relationships with their students are already tenuous. The students don't need to think that, you know, Sheriff John Wayne has come to town to enforce the law. And so even if it doesn't seem to be a tough sell for many members of the General Assembly, it may get more complicated in terms of its implementation actually at the school level.
As far as going through the General Assembly, does this trip it up at all?
I mean, I think there'll be a lot of emotional discussions because whenever you mention guns, people get very touchy. But what I'm hearing from people is, look, if we're going to have teachers in a school with guns, why wouldn't you want them trained? I mean, and what Hoosiers need to know is that 100 school districts could go out tomorrow and say all of our teachers are now going to be armed, and they're not required to have any training. And neither bill does require that, by the way.
No, it's just if you want the money from these funds, it's for training. It's
right.
Not just for buying a bunch of guns.
Right.
It is optional. No, if a school doesn't want to use this money for that purpose, they don't have to. And in that sense, what's the problem with it?
The problem is that this ignores the 800-pound gorilla in the room. The problem in our society and in Indiana is not the fact that we haven't trained the teachers on how to use weapons in the classroom. It's the fact that we have too many military-grade weapons in the hands of people that shouldn't have them. Okay, but we can't talk about reasonable regulations on guns because the NRA controls the Republican caucus in the Indiana General Assembly. And so until we get that taken care of and the NRA loses some of its power, we're never going to effectively address the question of gun violence in our society. This is just another, I'm sure they've even proposed this to show how responsible they're being, but they're not. We have too many people who die from gun violence because of military-grade weapons in the hands of people that shouldn't have them. And we won't deal with it.
I want to go back to the question I asked at the beginning of the conversation, which is, does this unnecessarily complicate the issue?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think we've, a couple things. I think we've found the needle in the haystack here with this particular piece of legislation or component in the legislation. Of course, if we are going to have teachers who are armed, I think that they should be trained. There are very few schools who do this. There are very few teachers who want to carry.
Yeah.
Right. So it's very limited. And so in funding the training, we're talking about, what, a couple $100 or something? I don't think this is a significant issue. What is important, I'm glad that there are a lot of different pieces of legislation aimed at school safety. And I want them all to get attention. There are several that are focused on, you know, hardening the target with doors and locks and buttons and cameras and all these sorts of things. I think more importantly, talking about root causes is one of the bills that's moving in the House allows for school safety money to be used for mental health services. In the Senate, Senator Crider just got a bill out of committee this week that would allocate grant money for schools who want to integrate mental health services in the schools. These are the kinds of things that we should be doing, and I'm glad we are.
Well, it's time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should school safety dollars be used for firearms training for teachers? A yes or B no. Last week's question, would a Howard Schultz presidential run as an independent affect President Trump's re-election chances? 85% say it'll help President Trump, 15% say it'll hurt the incumbent. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, the Township Government Reform Bill went down in flames this week on the House floor.
The proposed bill would have eliminated the state's township boards statewide, except in Marion County. That would leave those governmental units solely in the hands of township trustees. Monday, the House amended the bill to push back the date of that elimination to 2022 and create a study committee in the meantime. But those changes didn't ultimately matter because Tuesday, the House voting board lit up with red no votes when the bill was up for passage. It failed 18-75. The bill's author, Republican Representative Cindy Zimke, last year tried to eliminate many of the state's townships entirely in a bill that didn't even come up for a vote on the House floor.
Nikki Kelly, is wholesale township reform ultimately just dead?
Obviously, yes, this session. And honestly, I've been watching them have this debate for 20 years. I think it's time for, you know, lawmakers to maybe admit that Hoosiers like township government, or at least they don't hate it enough to pushed for it to be changed.
Yeah, I don't think it's Hoosiers that feel that way. I think it's the representatives who are afraid that those township officials will come into primary contests against
them. Oh, I don't know. I think lawmakers get a lot of calls about these bills.
But do they get them from Hoosiers, or do they get them from the township?
The township officials.
Some of them came out.
I mean,
they run in the same circle. Some of the members in the House and Senate now came out of that.
And they're afraid of
that. Was their minor league farm team?
The other ones, they'll.
I mean, this is probably a crass joke, but if you want to protect schools, make them hard targets so that they're impenetrable. Wrap them in township government, because it seems that in Indiana, that is the Holy Grail. You cannot, we've seen, I mean, go back to Shepard Kernan, whichever, yeah. whoever wants to come first. When there was, that was a high-profile recipe for reforming township government at a great savings to the state of Indiana, to local communities.
Very little on township reform.
And would arguably improve efficiency. We talked about that for years, and little pieces maybe here and there were implemented.
Nothing.
And now that there's sort of the momentum that had generated is gone, and so you do wonder if it ever, what would it would require for there to be significant reform.
At the same time, Cindy Zimke, who's kind of owned this issue the last couple of years at least, talked about how after last session she pushed really hard to eliminate like a third of townships statewide entirely. She won her townships in her re-election bid, so she's not feeling any heat for doing that. So are we just going to have this back and forth because on the one hand nobody's getting knocked out for it, but on the other hand it just doesn't get through?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they didn't punish her for offering a bill that didn't go anywhere.
I don't think they would have punished her if it had gone somewhere. That's not the problem. The problem isn't the local voters being outraged and trying to protect township government. It's the people that are in those township government offices who care.
We have more elected officials per capita than any state in the country.
Well, look at this.
We really do need to do something.
Yeah. Exactly.
We have 92 counties. We have 92 counties. We're a fraction of the size of New York, which has 42.
Well, this week saw the launch of a website to mark the accomplishments of now former Indiana Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly.
The site, joehelpedhoosiers.com, documents more than 60 legislative efforts led at least in part by Donnelly during his 6 years in the U.S. Senate. That includes military and veteran mental health legislation, measures to address the opioid epidemic, the Right to Try law modeled after an Indiana statute, and provisions to help the state's agricultural community. In a statement, Donnelly's former chief of staff, Joel Elliott, says the senator should be proud of his service. The website is paid for with Donnelly for Indiana campaign funds.
Jennifer Hollowell, does this feel more like a thank you card or priming a future campaign?
Well, I think the answer is partially in the question. It's paid for with campaign funds. And so it's obviously political. Some people have raised questions over whether it's a proper use of campaign funds if he isn't running for U.S. Senate. But no, it's definitely political. He's apparently considering running for something else again. And Democrats don't have a very good track record of recycling candidates over the last few years when they've brought folks back. It has not turned out well for them. So we'll see.
So you're rooting for Joe Donnelly to run for something?
Maybe.
Is Joe Donnelly running for something?
I don't know whether he's running for something, but I think, you know, in part this is just a function of a loyal staff that is proud of what he's enabled them to accomplish during his years in the Senate, and they want everybody to be aware that they're proud of him. And I think that's perfectly fine. I don't know if he runs again, but we shouldn't be talking about improper use of funds when we have Brian Bosma paying lawyers to go intimidate potential negative witnesses. So that
found
could be a problem.
Unanimously
permissible. Yeah, well, I don't think they analyzed it like a lawyer would analyze that situation, however.
I don't think we've ever seen anyone start a website after they were out of office to talk about what they
well,
did in
you can see whether Trump will do
money.
That after he loses.
Let me ask
year.
This. If this is Joe Donnelly's first step towards a run for something, is that good for the Indiana Democratic Party?
I don't know. I think a lot of Democrats really want to see new, fresh faces. And so in that sense, at least for those people, I think, you know, they'd like to move on.
Same question.
It's not as if he had been around for 30, 40, 50 years, so I think there's probably still some mileage left in Joe Donnelly, and I'm not sure that certainly losing a campaign is the disqualifier. If it ever was, I'm sure it's not now. Look, people are saying Beto O'Rourke, and, you know, he lost a bid in Texas, but maybe he's a president. Maybe let's go to the next office.
Mike Pence lost, too, remember.
Well, it's Nixon is the best example. You wouldn't have him to kick around anymore until you did, and he became president. So with the most common expression in politics, never say never. So this is the perfect use of never
say never. And I do want to ask you that question, which is, Nikki pointed out that I think a lot of young Democrats, a lot of Democrats, and particularly young Democrats, want younger, fresher faces. So is it negative for the Democratic Party to trot Joe Donnelly out for another big office?
I don't think so. If it's a big office, I don't think so. I mean, we have a lot of young blood in the Indiana General Assembly after this election, including a 25-year-old, which is a marked difference. A lot more women. A lot more first-time candidates and a lot younger people. So I think we have a bench that we're building. But it takes a little while to make the transition, it seems to me, from being in the General Assembly or the State Senate to a national office.
But how about
office?
Township office? That's what he aspires to. That's, we know that's,
what
where,
about
the,
from
we
mayor
know that's where the power is.
It's on the table. Yes. Finally, this week was, of course, Valentine's Day, if my tie didn't give it away. And Delaney, what is your Valentine message to the state of Indiana?
Pass a legitimate constitutional hate crimes bill and show us as being a tolerant state.
Very quickly,
Jen. I have
Jen.
A poem for you. Our state votes red, our budget's in the black. Thanks to Republicans, we're on the right track.
Oh, that's very good. That's
now, all we need are jobs that pay.
For this week, our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity on the new WFYI app.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.